Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 1st, Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19 in Colorado. Mask mandates are ending. Denver, Adams, and Arapahoe counties making change this week as cases fall. By Jessica Seaman and John Aguilar. Budget to keep RTD services reduced by John Murray. Tensions over Ukraine, Russia, U.S. exchange harsh words at UN by Edith M. Lederer. Affordable housing disappearing. New legislative report shows hundreds of thousands of units vanishing in just the last decade by Alex Burness. COVID-19 in Colorado. Mask mandates are ending. Denver, Adams, and Arapahoe counties making change this week as cases fall. By Jessica Seaman and John Aguilar, The Denver Post. Denver and two major metro counties will drop their mask mandates for businesses in indoor public spaces later this week, a move Mayor Michael Hancock called a pivot point in this battle against COVID-19. As a surge fueled by the Omicron variant wanes. The Tri-County Health Department on Monday went a step further than Denver, though, dropping mask requirements for schools in Adams and Arapahoe County as well. In a news briefing Monday morning, Hancock acknowledged the pandemic, which is nearing its third year, remains a public health emergency, and said face coverings will still be required for the foreseeable future in certain settings in Denver, including in K-12 schools and daycare facilities, as well as on public transportation. But, he said, this virus is something we're going to have to manage and learn to live with. Masks have been required in indoor public places in most of the metro area since late November, as officials in Denver, Jefferson, Adams, and Arapahoe counties enacted mandates to stem the spread of the virus and combat rising COVID-19 hospitalizations during the wave caused by the Delta variant. Denver's vax or mask mandate, which the city extended as Omicron overtook Delta in Colorado, allowed businesses that didn't want to require masks to instead only admit people who showed proof they were vaccinated against the virus. That order was set to expire on Thursday and will not be renewed. Beginning Friday, people will no longer be required under the public health order to wear a mask or show proof of vaccination for entry into a place of business in Denver, Hancock said. The Tri-County Health Department followed suit a few hours after Denver, with the agency's Board of Health voting 5-1 to end its mask mandate for public indoor spaces. But Tri-County's board also is ending mandatory masks inside schools. The mask orders will be lifted at the end of the day Friday, and the decision applies across Arapahoe and Adams counties. Tri-County Executive Director John Douglas cited an unprecedentedly dramatic drop in COVID-19 cases in the last 2 weeks, along with a decline in hospitalizations, for his recommendation to end the mask mandates. The metro counties are reviewing their face covering requirements this week, following continued declines in new COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and the rate at which tests are coming back positive. Last week, the state health department said its vaccination requirement for large indoor events will end. Colorado recorded 40,095 new cases of COVID-19 last week, down from the nearly 69,000 cases the previous week. Hospitalizations of people with the virus continue to drop as 1,300 people with confirmed COVID-19 were in hospitals statewide Monday, according to data from the State Department of Public Health and Environment. The number of people who died with COVID-19 rose during the first 2 weeks of January, the first increases following the decline out of the Delta wave's November peak. According to state data, 175 people with COVID-19 died during the first week of January, and 196 died the second week. Because death reports lag, it's too soon to compare more recent weeks. So far, more than 11,500 Coloradans have died due to the virus, according to the state health department. Colorado's state modeling team predicts COVID-19 cases will decrease through February, but transmission remains high, with the team estimating last week that 1 in 19 Coloradans were contagious and that many people likely will still get infected over the next month, even as cases decline. Modeling has shown that lifting the mask mandate in Denver will not affect the trajectory of the current drop in COVID-19 cases. Bob McDonald, executive director of the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment, said during Monday's briefing, "Omicron has run out of fuel," he said. Students in Denver schools and daycares are still required to wear masks because children under 5 are not eligible for COVID-19 vaccines, and face coverings can help keep kids in class by reducing the scenarios under which they have to quarantine at home after being exposed to the virus, McDonald said. Getting vaccinated remains the best protection against the virus, Hancock said. The reason there's still uncertainty around this pandemic is because there's still too many people who are unvaccinated, he said. The Tri-County Health Department met Monday to discuss whether to extend its mask requirements for schools and child care facilities in Adams and Arapahoe counties, and Jefferson County's Board of Health will hold a meeting Thursday to consider whether to lift the county's mask requirement, including in schools. Douglas, the head of Tri-County, said the 7-day incidence rate had dropped from more than 1,400 daily coronavirus cases just 2 weeks ago to fewer than 600 cases a day this week. The peak of cases, he said, was January 11th, when 1,800 were recorded. Everyone's moving the same way, Douglas said. Intensive care beds, he said, have become much more available in the 10-county area making up north-central Colorado, including Metro Denver. Since mid-January, he said there's been the greatest sustained increase in hospital capacity in many months. He credited widespread infection from the highly contagious Omicron variant with the sharply dropping number of new cases in Colorado. "We probably have peaked, and it's probably going to decline rapidly," Douglas said. He said 80% of Coloradans should be immune to Omicron, either through vaccination or infection, by the middle of February. Jefferson County Public Health said in a statement that discussions about ending mask mandates are steps toward a sustainable, safe off-ramp for public health mitigation measures as our community works to transition to treating COVID-19 as an endemic disease, meaning one that is present but controlled in our community. Boulder, which mandated face coverings in September ahead of the other metro counties, did not answer a question about whether it is reconsidering its order. "The health department is constantly evaluating important public health metrics, including the severity and impact of Omicron, the availability of treatments to all age groups, and the availability of testing in high-quality masks," said Angela Cimental, spokeswoman for Boulder County Public Health, in an email. "At this time, the order remains in effect for all indoor public spaces. Counties outside of the metro area have moved to rescind mask mandates as well. Summit County ended its order last week, and Larimer County announced Monday that its mask rule will expire February 12th. Special report, budget to keep RTD service reduced, by John Murray, The Denver Post. Metro Denver's transit agency is a long way from the dark days of 2020, when the initial fallout of the pandemic gave rise to fears of recurring $250 million budget deficits and plans to slash more than 600 jobs. But the Regional Transportation District is by no means in the clear. It won't have enough money in the next 5 years to restore all the service it's cut. the agency's latest forecasts show. That's true even as the sales tax collections it depends upon to pay for most operating costs have fully recovered, helping to stabilize this year's $771 million operating budget. The best RTD can afford, according to its financial plans, is to get back to 85% of pre-pandemic service levels by 2027, up from the current level of roughly 70%. A review of RTD's budget picture by the Denver Post found that spending and borrowing decisions made over more than a decade have limited the agency's ability to devote its resources, including significant amounts of recent federal aid, fully to pandemic recovery. To restore more service, the agency also needs to hire enough staff to overcome double-digit shortages on its operations teams. Then there's the question of whether ridership, still stuck at about 53% of pre-pandemic levels as of November, will rebound enough to justify it. Those other factors ultimately may prove more decisive when it comes to restoring service in the state's largest transit system. But the financial challenges have piled up. The agency is contending with a $290 million backlog in maintenance and asset replacement costs, much of that deferred in the years before the pandemic hit, as officials made decisions such as opting to squeeze more time out of aging buses. Its leaders have given that backlog priority for the next several years, on top of new capital items coming due. Freed up by the federal pandemic aid it's receiving, the agency's top budget official says RTD can shift more sales tax money for that purpose. As part of that backlog, the agency's board last week approved a $70 million order for 142 new buses. In coming years, RTD will also face rising debt payments for some of the $5.6 billion in Fast Tracks rail expansions during the 2010s. They were built amid a severe budget crunch in the program as costs soared and tax collections came in under projections, requiring creative financing and partnerships to pull them off. That included loans with mainly interest-only payments initially. RTD could be forced to siphon money from its base system, which covers operations for the older light rail lines and most of its bus system, to help cover the resulting $226 million projected shortfall through 2027 on the Fast Track side of the ledger. The base system will have extra money available to do that, owing to older project bonds that will be paid off in 2024. But the assist could come at the cost of potential investments in more bus service or other programs. From a financial standpoint, I'm genuinely concerned about the level of service that we're going to be able to operate in the future, as soon as 2025, 2026, or even 2028, said Director Chantel Lewis, who represents areas including Northwest Denver on RTD's 15-member elected board. We can talk about the budget in terms of dollars and cents, but really we're talking about the lives of the individuals who depend upon our service and have throughout the pandemic. As they face potentially constrained budgets, RTD leaders are in the middle of rethinking how they can provide service across more than 2,300 square miles, one of the nation's largest urban transit agency footprints. The Reimagine RTD initiative, which kicked off before the pandemic, recently produced a system optimization plan, now under public review. The plan would establish a guide map for the restoration of routes and major adjustments of service in the next 5 years if it wins the board's approval in March. The goal is that by the time RTD achieves its target of restoring 85% of service, what it provides will be more efficient, serving more riders than would be achieved by simply reversing pandemic cuts. But the resulting shifts likely would mean eliminating some outlying suburban routes as RTD improves service for its core daily riders in more populated places. That could set up contentious board votes for some service changes. Agency CFO says he's cautiously optimistic. RTD would have faced the bulk of the coming financial crunches without the pandemic, but they have made budgeting extra tricky for the foreseeable future. They've strained the agency's ability to pivot if ridership, contrary to expectation, resurges quickly once the pandemic fades. Doug McLeod, RTD's chief financial officer, said the Fast Track's debt plans and asset management deferrals were decided in tough budget circumstances. He views the overall financial picture as brighter now in some ways, owing in large part to $774 million in total aid allocations from three pandemic relief packages passed by Congress since March 2020. "I think we need to be cautiously optimistic," McLeod said. "I think we're in a lot better shape than we were a year and a half ago, but there's so much more uncertainty to just throw caution to the wind financially and commit to things that we may not be able to fund in the future." The agency has used or committed just more than half of the pandemic relief money, relying on it to avoid massive layoffs in the last 2 years, cover unforeseen costs, and keep its operations solvent. RTD's five-year financial plan calls for using the final $304 million to pad out its budgets through 2024 in increments of just more than $101 million. Stretching the relief funding out may be a shrewd budget move, but industry observers say some transit agencies have put more of their shares to use sooner. A study prepared for the American Public Transportation Association last fall found that among 74 agencies surveyed, a majority planned to return to offering full service within a year, even as many were weathering operator shortages and other pressures. "That was sort of a policy choice on the part of RTD to respond with more caution, because I think that they are more concerned about long-term revenues," said Yona Freemark, a senior research associate at the Urban Institute, who co-authored the study. McLeod and other RTD officials defend their approach as fiscally responsible. In mid-January, Fitch Ratings, one of the three major credit rating agencies, gave RTD's overall approach a favorable assessment, upgrading its debt ratings to a stable outlook based in part on strong revenue growth prospects. Sales and use tax collections returned to normal last year, and even ahead of pre-pandemic levels. RTD projected nearly $736 million in collections through the end of December, about 11% higher than in 2019, from the combined 1% dedicated regional sales tax for its base system and the Fast Tracks program. Farebox revenues are still a long way from recovering. They were on track to come in at $77 million last year, about half what fares raised in 2019. Beyond ridership recovery, future fare collections also will depend on the outcome of a study underway now that's aimed at evaluating and possibly reducing how much people pay to ride buses and trains. RTD has faced criticism for both the cost and complexity of its fare structure, which sets local fares at $3 and regional fares at $5.25, but allows discounts for some groups. RTD's brand has declined here locally. RTD's five-year financial plan factors in one other headwind for the coming years: the return of revenue growth caps under the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights on its base system after 2024, once the agency finishes paying off those older bonds. They were issued for the T-Rex project, which added light rail to the Southeast Interstate 25 corridor as part of a major highway expansion completed in 2006. McLeod says a rough estimate is that the Tabor caps, which factor in inflation and population growth, will trim $81.7 million from sales tax collections between 2025 and 2027, and more after that. RTD leaders soon will evaluate whether to ask voters in the district to remove those caps, called a debrucing, which would allow RTD to keep taxes collected above the limit. But RTD potentially faces a problem, a lack of trust among many voters. "I think one of the things that has struck me in the last decade or so is that the agency is very well respected nationally. I mean, among their peers and in the industry," said Ben Bryan, a commercial real estate consultant who serves on RTD's Community Advisory Committee and long has advocated for public transportation in Denver. "And yet, At the same time, their popular image or their brand has declined here locally. Brian attributes that gap primarily to Fast Tracks, with all its struggles, delays, and successes, as well as the failure to finish it, despite some Herculean efforts. It's also rooted in decisions to suspend popular but labor-intensive offerings, including the Broncos ride bus service on game days prior to the pandemic. People's expectations were so high, and I don't think they've been able to meet those expectations, he said. Still hanging over RTD is a big financial question. Should the agency fulfill its 2004 promise to voters who approved the Fast Tracks plan and find a way to finish out roughly $2.2 billion in unfunded projects? Last year, the board approved the latest study to assess the viability of building a limited service alternative for the costliest component, an extension of the B Line commuter rail up to Boulder and Longmont, though it's shown limited ridership potential. I want RTD to be a transportation choice. The Northwest Rail Line aside, Board Chair Vince Buzik said in an interview, "I want RTD to be a transportation choice. I want not only the people who need to have it, but I also want the people who say, hey, let's go to the art museum, to have it as an option." But others, including Lewis, would rather see RTD respond to what they see as the most pressing service needs, especially as the pandemic has reduced commuting into downtown from the suburbs. RTD has floated plans for projects that are more cost-effective than building rail, including working with local governments to build bus rapid transit lines to speed service on heavily used bus corridors. Planning is underway with the City of Denver for a bus rapid transit line along East Colfax Avenue. Deborah Johnson, who became RTD's general manager and CEO in late 2020, said RTD shouldn't shy away from difficult decisions as it faces the challenges of the pandemic. Let's stop talking about what was. Let's work on solutions that are within our reach, she said. And let's ensure that we're talking to people that are utilizing our system because they understand the complexities, they understand what the problems are. So I and my team are listening to their pain points because that will help us to identify the problem for which we're trying to solve. As it grapples with its pandemic reduced schedule and a tight budget, the agency is in line to get more outside help, starting with a boost in its annual federal funding by tens of millions of dollars a year for the next 5 years under the $1 trillion infrastructure bill passed by Congress last fall. That money typically is restricted mostly to capital expenses, paying for projects or train cars, say, but not for their operating costs. Less restricted money could come from newly expanded state grant-based programs intended to boost transit and other alternatives to driving, especially in Metro Denver, which exceeds federal limits for ozone emissions. So far, RTD's leaders are taking a cautious approach to the state programs. State Senator Faith Winter, a Westminster Democrat, said lawmakers' intention was that the programs could cover operating costs in some cases. RTD is in talks with Governor Jared Polis, Winter, and other lawmakers to create a pilot program this summer, initially eyeballed at a $28 million state cost that would provide transit riders with free fares on high ozone days or potentially on a wider scale during the season. I think that's going to be an important first step, Winter said, adding, it could be the ideological and logistical shift we need to be better partners and do bigger things. Tensions over Ukraine. Russia and U.S. exchange harsh words at UN by Edith M. Lederer, The Associated Press, byline, United Nations. Russia accused the West on Monday of whipping up tensions over Ukraine and said the U.S. had brought pure Nazis to power in Kiev, as the UN Security Council had a stormy and bellicose debate on Moscow's troop buildup near its southern neighbor. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield shot back that Russia's growing military force of more than 100,000 troops along Ukraine's border was the largest mobilization in Europe in decades, adding that there has been a spike in cyber attacks and Russian disinformation. And they are attempting, without any factual basis, to paint Ukraine and Western countries as the aggressors to fabricate a pretext for attack, she said. The harsh exchanges in the Security Council came as Moscow lost an attempt to block the meeting and reflected the gulf between the two nuclear powers. It was the first open session where all protagonists in the Ukraine crisis spoke publicly, even though the UN's most powerful body took no action. Hours later, the Russian government sent a written response to a U.S. proposal aimed at de-escalating the Ukraine crisis, according to three Biden administration officials. The officials all spoke on the condition of anonymity. A State Department official declined to offer details of the response, saying it would be unproductive to negotiate in public, and they would leave it up to Russia to discuss their counterproposal. Although more high-level diplomacy is expected this week, talks between the U.S. and Russia have so far failed to ease tensions in the crisis, with the West saying Moscow is preparing for an invasion. Russia denies it is planning to attack. It demands pledges that Ukraine will never join NATO, a halt to the deployment of NATO weapons near Russian borders, and a rollback of the alliance's forces from Eastern Europe. NATO and the U.S. call those non-starters. Russian Ambassador Vasily Nebenzia accused the Biden administration of whipping up tensions and rhetoric and provoking escalation. "You are almost pulling for this," he said, looking at Thomas Greenfield. "You want it to happen. You're waiting for it to happen, as if you want to make your words become a reality." He blamed the U.S. for the 2014 ouster of a Kremlin-friendly president in Kiev, saying it brought to power nationalists, radicals, Russophobes, and pure Nazis, and created the antagonism that exists between Ukraine and Russia. "If they hadn't done this, then we to date would be living in a spirit of good neighborly relations and mutual cooperation," Nebenzia said. However, some in the West just don't clearly like this positive scenario. What's happening today is yet another attempt to drive a wedge between Russia and Ukraine. Nebenzia pointedly left the council chamber as the Ukrainian ambassador, Sergei Kislytsa, started to speak. "How long Russia will pursue a clear attempt to push Ukraine and its partners into a Kafka trap," Kislytsa said. The vote on holding an open meeting passed 10-2, with Russia and China opposed and India, Gabon, and Kenya abstaining. 9 yes votes were needed for the meeting to go ahead. China's ambassador, Zhang Jun, said he voted against the public meeting because what is urgently needed now is quiet diplomacy, not megaphone diplomacy. The U.S. and its allies had pressed to hold the meeting Monday, the last day of Norway's rotating presidency of the Council, before Russia takes over Tuesday for the month of February. Any statement or resolution by the Security Council is extremely unlikely, given Russia's veto power and its ties with others on the Council, including China. After all 15 Council members spoke, the U.S. and Russia sparred again, with Thomas Greenfield saying she was disappointed in Nebenzia's comments, stressing that Russian threats of aggression are provocative. "I say to Russia simply this, your actions will speak for themselves," the U.S. envoy said. Nebenzia shot back, "Everything that we wanted to say is in our statement today. However, we really just don't understand what threats and provocations and escalation by Russia is being talked about." U.S. President Joe Biden said in a statement that the meeting was a critical step in rallying the world to speak out in one voice, to reject the use of force and seek military de-escalation. At the start of a White House meeting with the ruling Emir of Qatar, Biden said the U.S. continues to engage in nonstop diplomacy, but we are ready no matter what happens. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken did not make any visible progress in easing the tensions at their meeting in Geneva earlier this month. They are expected to speak by phone Tuesday, according to the Russian Foreign Ministry. A senior State Department official confirmed the Russian account. Biden warned Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in a phone call Tuesday that there is a distinct possibility Russia could begin an incursion in February, but the Ukrainian leader sought to play down the war fears, saying Western alarm over an imminent invasion has prompted many investors in the country's financial markets to cash out. Zelensky said Friday that we aren't seeing any escalation bigger than before, and charged that the Russian buildup could be an attempt by Moscow to exert psychological pressure and sow panic. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will visit Ukraine on Tuesday for talks with Zelensky, and will also speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin to urge him to step back, Johnson's office said. Johnson said he is considering sending hundreds of British troops to NATO countries in the Baltic region as a show of strength. Speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week, Thomas Greenfield said of Russia, "We are going into the room prepared to listen to them, but we're not going to be distracted by their propaganda." Affordable housing disappearing. New legislative report shows hundreds of thousands of units vanishing in just the last decade. By Alex Burness, The Denver Post. A new Statehouse report underscores what is already obvious to millions of Coloradans, former Coloradans, and would-be Coloradans. It's really expensive to live here, and it's getting worse. In the last decade alone, the state has lost 300,000 naturally occurring housing units that people making $45,000 or less can afford without spending more than 30% of their income on housing. That is well more than 10% of the state's entire housing stock, which census data show is somewhere north of 2.5 million overall units. That's according to the report published Friday by the Affordable Housing Transformational Task Force, a group of state lawmakers and subject matter experts convened over the summer and fall to decide how to spend an historic infusion of stimulus cash. This year's state budget, projected to sit at $40 billion, will feature at least $400 million more for housing than in previous years due to federal legislation passed during the COVID-19 pandemic. In many parts of the state, the concept of affordable housing produced organically by the market, as opposed to through government intervention, is essentially dead, said State Representative Dylan Roberts, an Avon Democrat who chaired the Task Force on Housing. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology's research on self-sufficiency standards by state and county indicates there is almost nowhere in Colorado where an adult with one child can live on $40,000 without spending in the red or cutting back on essentials such as food and health care. It's especially pronounced in the hotter housing markets of the state, including Eagle and Rout counties in Roberts' district. I hear that constituents are constantly having to make the decision as to whether they can stay in that area and afford to live there. They want to raise their family there, but they can't find a place to own or even rent, Roberts said. Gretchen Hovey, who runs a popular bakery and restaurant in Edwards, said she offers $24 an hour, nearly $50,000 a year, for a full-time worker at the low end of her staff's pay scale, and between $30 and $35 an hour for other staff. That's often still not enough to keep up with the cost of living in her mountain community outside Vail. The prices of rent are so high. It's $2,000 for a bedroom in a multi-bedroom house you're sharing with roommates, she said. Hovey added, I don't think we're going to have a workforce. It's not just restaurants, but everything it takes to have a resort community, the housekeepers and landscapers and the property managers. We're going to lose the people who make this community work. Acknowledging that market-based solutions are failing to meet the housing needs of people, not only in pricier spots like Edwards, but all around the state. Lawmakers vow to make this legislative session about producing as many affordable units as possible, and in as many places as possible. The task force recommends, and bills will soon state, that Colorado should use this cash infusion to create grants and incentives for developers and local governments around the state to prioritize affordable housing, which in many cases will mean dense, multifamily housing. About $150 million of the total spending would go to a revolving loan fund that is constantly replenished. The entire project of manufacturing a supply of affordable housing that the market evidently won't produce on its own relies heavily on cooperation from towns and cities, which will receive their own smaller infusions of federal cash. But at the same time that lawmakers unveil legislation and promise to work to reverse the extinction course, they are clear-eyed about how $400 million is a relatively small amount in this context. When the task force got started this summer, said Vice Chair and State Senator Julie Gonzalez, we were really excited. Oh my gosh, finally we have money to do something here at the Capitol to address this crisis. Added Gonzalez, a Denver Democrat who lives in an affordable housing unit, then we actually started listening to Coloradans to understand the full scale and depth of the problem. When you're talking about someone working two jobs to make ends meet, they weren't able to do that in downtown Denver or in Eagle or in Alamosa or in Walsenburg or anywhere else in the state. So we realized $400 million is both a lot of money and also is only part of the solution. For many who have had to move out of state or who couldn't afford to move here in the first place, it's too late. That's especially true for older Coloradans who are being displaced at near nation-leading rates, and for the poorest working Coloradans, for whom the state estimates there are about 100,000 fewer affordable housing units than are demanded. It's increasingly true for middle-class folks, too. The task force report stated bluntly, middle-income families can no longer afford to buy or rent a home. Democrats control the legislature and thus control this task force. But there was generally high bipartisan recognition of the problem, of several useful policy responses, and of the limits of an inflated state budget to solve the problem. State Senator Rob Woodward, a Loveland Republican, said, I think overall we can have an economic impact that does reduce the trajectory of the cost of housing. Could it be better? Yes. Douglas County. District's leader is issued an ultimatum. Majority is trying to oust the superintendent but didn't tell the rest of the board, members allege, by Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. The president and vice president of the Douglas County School District Board of Education issued an undisclosed ultimatum to the district superintendent to resign or otherwise be voted out, all without informing the rest of the board, according to three board members who made the allegations Monday night. In a striking public meeting, the three board members, Elizabeth Hansen, Susan Meek, and David Ray, said they found out Friday that the board's president and vice president, Mike Peterson and Christy Williams, had issued the ultimatum to Superintendent Corey Wise, giving him until Wednesday morning to decide his course of action. There is no vote, no meeting, and no notice that this would be happening, the three directors said Monday night in a Zoom meeting. We're not just whining, said Ray, the District F director. We're genuinely concerned we've got a board that's off the rails in terms of following not only the law, but also the policies that keep us governing effectively. The directors who spoke Monday believe these actions violated Colorado open meeting laws, which govern how decisions can be discussed and decided by public officials, and said the board members are not authorized to take these actions on their own without informing the rest of the board. I fully understand if four members want to vote one way, said Meek, who represents District A. That's a majority, but it needs to be done in accordance with law and in accordance with policy and procedure. Hansen, who is also an attorney, said she would be filing an ethics complaint with the state over the conduct of one of the board's attorneys, Will Trachman. The attorney, Hansen said, met with Peterson and Williams to give legal advice on whether they could issue Wise the ultimatum. Trachman is obligated under his contract to write memos to other directors if he meets with them individually, she said, but the three directors said they've received nothing. I'm not comfortable having an individual on our payroll who is not in compliance with his contract legally and ethically, Hansen said. This needs to be addressed immediately as well. As for why the board's majority wants Wise out, the three directors said during the meeting that they were told the rest of the board had collectively decided we need to take the district in a different direction. were mystified, Ray told the Denver Post after the meeting. Given the circumstances, Wise has performed admirably as superintendent, he said. I have no issues or concerns with his leadership, Ray said. Paula Hans, a spokesperson for the school district, said via text Monday night that Wise had not resigned. Despite rumors circulating in our community, the DCSD Board of Education has not taken a vote with regard to the superintendent, she said. Peterson reached via text, said he was not watching the meeting and would have to review it. He directed further comment to the school district. Ray, Hansen, and Meek said a special meeting needs to be called in the near future so the entire board can discuss the superintendent's future. We need to be true to our word. We need to follow the law. We need to have conversations as a 7-member board, Meek said. The Douglas County School Board has undergone a major makeover in recent months, following the election in November of 4 new members, including Peterson, Williams, and 2 others, Kaylee Weiniger and Becky Myers. The 4 members shifted the board's political balance rightward, and they garnered significant donations from national conservative groups. The conservative-leaning majority has wasted little time tackling hot-button issues, voting last week to change the district's equity policy, which was passed in response to the racial justice movement sparked in 2020 by the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota. Marshall Fire. Boulder County will pick contractor to clear homes, by Noelle Phillips, The Denver Post. Boulder County officials expect to select a company next week to clean up what's left of the homes destroyed by the Marshall Fire in late December, a job that will take months to complete and cost tens of millions of dollars. Cleanup has been one of the biggest questions for people who lost their homes in the 6,000-acre wildfire on December 30th because no one can rebuild until their property is cleared of debris and hazardous waste. These disaster recovery contracts are worth tens of millions of dollars. The county can be reimbursed for much of the money, and the competition to win them is fierce. Only a handful of companies in the United States are qualified to handle such cleanup jobs, which require expertise in scooping up and hauling hazardous waste on a large scale and in a short amount of time. Boulder County's request for proposal on the wildfire cleanup is 70 pages long, and on Wednesday, the county posted a 76-page addendum to after prospective bidders submitted questions about the bid process and the demands of the job. Bids are due Tuesday, and the county hopes to pick a contractor during the second week of February, according to a Boulder County news release. The same contractor will oversee the cleanup of properties in Louisville, Superior, and unincorporated Boulder County. Typically, the county awards contracts to the lowest bidder, said Andrew Barth, a spokesman for Boulder County Public Works Department. We will go through their qualifications to see the work they have completed to see if they are viable to do the work, Barth said. There's a couple of large ones that are here and ready to go if they get the contract. Barth did not know a ballpark figure of what the cleanup could cost. However, industry experts estimate the entire project could cost more than $100 million. In Graves County, Kentucky, the Federal Emergency Management Agency reserved $120 million for debris cleanup after a massive tornado destroyed downtown Mayfield in December. But that cleanup doesn't involve as much toxic waste as what is created in a fire. Homeowners who register for the county's debris cleanup program should not pay out of pocket for their lots to be cleared. Boulder County will collect payments from their insurance companies, then apply to FEMA to have 75% of the expenses reimbursed. The county and state will be responsible for the remaining 25% of the costs, according to information on the county's Marshall Fire website. Boulder County's request for proposal estimates there are 1,118 destroyed structures, 353 damaged buildings, and 1,741 trees that need to be removed. The request for proposal details how the work will be carried out as crews clean the piles of charred homes from the burn area. Each site is likely to be contaminated by various products, such as car batteries, electronics, household chemicals, and asbestos used in building materials. The ash also creates a health hazard when it is stirred into the air, and there are requirements for dust control and air quality monitoring. The rules surrounding the hauling of hazardous waste specify which landfills in Colorado are permitted to accept it. A firm hired to monitor the cleanup must collect invoices and document every load hauled away from a burned property. There also are requirements for recycling metals and concrete and for composting vegetation when possible. Meanwhile, Boulder County already has collected hundreds of pounds of spoiled food and removed almost 200 destroyed cars from the streets, according to a county news release. And curbside collection of furniture, appliances, landscaping, and other household items ruined by the wind and smoke began Monday. The pickup of those materials will last for 2 weeks. There are other deadlines for Marshall Fire Recovery in the next week. Anyone who wants to participate in the county's debris removal and site cleanup program has until February 8th to fill out a right of entry form, which gives contractors and county employees permission to enter the property and start removing debris. Those who do not complete the form will be responsible for their own cleanup. To find forms, visit tinyurl.com/Marshall Fire Debris. Finally, the deadline to apply for disaster unemployment assistance with the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment is Wednesday. That program provides unemployment payments to people who lost their jobs because of the Marshall Fire. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/disaster unemployment. Passenger traffic. DIA is getting closer to near normal levels, by John Murray, the Denver Post. New passenger traffic totals released by Denver International Airport for 2021 show it's close to seeing pre-pandemic levels of travel again, but the turmoil of the past 2 years has altered key dynamics. A greater share of DIA's passengers than normal came through on connecting flights last year. That likely was a function of another dynamic. Significantly fewer international flights than usual arrived in or departed from Denver, as domestic travel experienced a far quicker recovery, DIA says. Overall, 58.8 million passengers traveled through DIA last year, the airport said Monday in a news release. That was down nearly 15% from the record 69 million passengers the airport saw in 2019, the last year before the pandemic. But in 2021, the total was up a whopping 74% over 2020, when the onset of the pandemic sent passenger traffic plummeting to a near-record low in DIA's 27-year history. As the recovery continued, the second half of the year was off from the same period in 2019 by just 6%, DIA says. There was some slowing evident during the holiday period, however, with December traffic off by 7%, a period that coincided with the surge in COVID-19 cases driven by the Omicron variant. It's encouraging to see DEN's passenger traffic continue to rebound toward pre-pandemic levels, CEO Phil Washington said in the news release, referring to DIA by its airport code. Our large domestic market and robust hub network, combined with Denver's resilient economy, make DEN an attractive opportunity for airlines. I'm especially optimistic about the steady return of international passengers as we look forward to welcoming new visitors and opening more doors to the world in 2022. Airlines at DIA expect to offer nearly 6% more capacity in the first half of 2022 than they did during the same period in 2019, according to DIA's release, with much of that driven by international flights that are set to resume. DIA has outpaced most major airports in its pandemic recovery, both in the United States and abroad. During the first 10 months of 2021, according to DIA's tracking, it was the third busiest airport in the world in terms of passenger traffic, behind the Atlanta and Dallas-Fort Worth airports. Official numbers for the full year aren't yet available, but that distinction is likely to fade as European and coastal U.S. airports ramp up their operations this year. In a recent report, S&P Global, a major credit rating agency, forecasts that U.S. airports were likely to recapture about 90% of pre-pandemic activity this year. In many ways, DIA has been ahead of that resurgence, sometimes to the dismay of passengers who contended in the fall with long security wait times, parking shortages, and other hassles that prompted DIA to adjust its approaches in recent months. Among the 2021 trends highlighted by DIA, United Airlines retained its status as the airport's largest carrier, with 44% of the market share based on scheduled flights, followed by Southwest Airlines, 32%, and Frontier Airlines, 11%. Southwest gained the most, growing by 5 percentage points, as it lost the least traffic compared to 2019. Connecting passengers accounted for 41% of traffic, up 5 percentage points compared to 2019. Passengers traveling to or from other U.S. cities made up 97% of traffic. International traffic accounted for 1.9 million passengers, which was down 40% compared to 2019, but it was double the international traffic through DIA in 2020, when such travel was curtailed sharply. Aeromexico and Volaris, which primarily serve Mexican destinations, grew in passenger traffic at DIA last year, along with Allegiant, an ultra-low-cost carrier. The volume of cargo carried into or out of DIA slightly exceeded 2019 levels and grew by 2% over 2020. That market has been more stable than passenger travel during the pandemic. In a news brief, teen charged after Aurora shooting. One of the teens arrested last month in connection with a drive-by shooting outside an Aurora high school in November faces 20 counts for his alleged role in the violent incident that left six high school students injured. Daniel Rulas, 16, was charged with 16 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 3 counts of first-degree assault, and 1 count of possession of a handgun by a juvenile, the 18th Judicial District Attorney's Office said Monday in a news release. Rulis is one of 4 teens to be arrested in connection with the November 15 shooting in Nome Park, just steps away from Aurora Central High School. The mayhem, which occurred during school lunch, sent terrified students fleeing from the park and forced hundreds of others to lock down at Aurora Central High. This was from Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. Tobacco. Shops fined for selling without licenses, by Joe Urbino, the Denver Post. 23 businesses in Denver were handed $150 fines on Monday after being warned they did not have the proper licenses required for retailers selling tobacco in the city. The round of tickets stems from licensing requirement that the City Council passed in 2019 and officially took effect last year. There are also a salvo from the city's Department of Excise and Licenses announcing it is keeping a close eye on businesses that don't live up to laws aimed at preventing youth tobacco use. The licensing requirement for retail tobacco sales is a critical tool Denver has used to hold businesses accountable if they sell tobacco to minors, Department Director Molly Duplichane said in a statement Monday. We hope this enforcement action today will result in Denver achieving 100% compliance with the tobacco licensing requirements. The retail tobacco store license was created through an ordinance that also increased the minimum to buy cigarettes, vape pens, and other tobacco products in Denver to 21. Federal lawmakers made the national legal age to buy tobacco products 21 just months after the Denver City Council passed its law. The store licensing piece was delayed because of the COVID-19 pandemic and to give retailers more time to comply, according to city officials. The deadline to get a license was moved to July 1st of last year. The 23 stores penalized Monday not only did not meet that deadline, they also did not take action after being warned they were out of compliance, according to the licensing department. The businesses cited included liquor stores, neighborhood convenience stores, and some shops that sell smoking and vaping products and accessories. 11 Family Dollar stores were on the list. The fines are $150, but if the businesses continue to sell tobacco products without licenses, that figure will go up to $500 for a second citation and $999 for a third. The city's goal is to avoid more fines and to get the businesses into the licensing market, excises and licensing spokesman Eric Escudero said Monday. In December, Mayor Michael Hancock vetoed another city council ordinance targeting youth tobacco and nicotine use, a measure that would have banned the sale of any flavored products, including menthol cigarettes. City Councilman Jolan Clark, who voted for the flavor ban before voting in support of letting the veto stand, was among the council members who said they would prefer the city use its licensing and code enforcement authority to crack down on retailers who sell smoking products to underage buyers and not resort to wide-reaching product bans. "We have found a way for 21-plus stores to work for marijuana, and I really believe that if we can get the enforcement and the fines and the taking away of licenses there, we can make it work for tobacco stores," Clark said in December. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.